Radio Prague can be contacted at Czech Radio 7, Radio Prague, Vinohradska 12, and I'll spell that, Vinohradska 12, 120-99, Prague 2, Czech Republic. We break now for news on the hour on CBC Radio 1.
Here is the CBC Hourly News. I'm Jim Martin. More American soldiers have been killed in Iraq. Two soldiers from the 101st Airborne Division were killed and another wounded in the northern part of the country early today when their convoy was struck by rocket-propelled grenades and gunshots. There were no reported enemy casualties and no arrests were made. U.S. soldiers have come under increasing attacks in recent weeks. These deaths bring to 151 the number of American soldiers killed in action since the March 20th start of the war. American troops, meanwhile, have started to recruit Iraqis for a new national army. The Americans say they'll begin training the Iraqis next month and hope to have a battalion of about 1,000 men by October. The new army will be used to guard the frontiers. British and American troops will continue to be responsible for security in Iraq. Johnny Diamond reports.
The new Iraqi army will be open to men aged 18 to 40, with some exceptions. Members of the senior officer corps of the army that served the old regime, of the security and intelligence forces, and of the upper reaches of the Ba'ath Party are not allowed to apply. Offering pay of $60 a month, it is not expected to be short of recruits. The new army will not be responsible for internal security. That will remain the task of coalition forces, which lost another member early on Saturday morning local time. An American soldier was shot in Baghdad whilst guarding a bank. U.S. troops have detained just over 1,200 people and seized thousands of mortars and rocket-propelled grenades in two separate operations this week. Asked if he was winning what Washington now calls a guerrilla war, the leader of coalition forces, General Ricardo Sanchez, was positive.
The war that we're fighting is against the former regime leadership. It's against terrorists and criminals. We are winning this war.
The two operations this week are trumpeted by the U.S. as considerable successes, but the mass detentions and the aggressive search tactics are deeply resented by Iraqis. Coalition leaders may believe they are winning the war, but many on the ground think they're losing the peace. For CBC News, this is Johnny Diamond in Baghdad.
The first deployment of Canadian troops for peacekeeping duties in Afghanistan left Canadian Forces Base Trenton Saturday afternoon. Task Force Kabul is Canada's contribution to the NATO-led International Security Assistance Force in Afghanistan. There will be 1,800 soldiers over the next few weeks and 1,800 others next year. The Canadian military estimates 5 to 10 of its soldiers could be killed during the full 12-month mission. John McCallum is Minister of Defense.
It is our fervent hope that that number will be minimized to be absolutely zero, but in the military world, in a world of suicide bombers, there are no guarantees.
Canadian forces begin patrolling Kabul next month. According to an Ottawa newspaper report, the cost of getting Canada's bargain second-hand submarine shipshape is far exceeding expectations. The Ottawa Citizen says the budget for spare parts and engineering support is more than doubled to $192 million and will continue to climb. The Defense Department is asking for more money to cover in-service support costs. Canada bought the four subs from Britain for $750 million. Numerous problems with the vessels and a reallocation of finances on the war on terrorism have kept the new boats out of service. Heads of state, movie stars, celebrities, and business leaders paid tribute to former South African President Nelson Mandela on his 85th birthday yesterday in Johannesburg. Jane Francis Kelly reports.
The audience had a liberal sprinkling of celebrities and dignitaries. Retired Archbishop Desmond Tutu, the Hollywood actor John Cusack, and Bono from the rock band U2. Their appreciation was obvious. Nelson Mandela, who is celebrating his 85th year, came onto the stage with Hillary Clinton. They were joined by Mr. Mandela's wife and the former President of the United States, Bill Clinton. Mandela's enduring gift to South Africa has been his ability to unify the country. And it was seen as a true honor to be invited to a gala dinner this evening in celebration of his birthday.
That's the BBC's Jane Francis Kelly in Johannesburg. And that's the CBC News.
Hi, and welcome to CBC Radio Overnight, when we bring you CBC News on the Hour and information programming from other public broadcasters around the globe. I'm Judy Madryn. For the next half hour, we present Radio Sweden. This is CBC Radio 1.
Sounds from a Stockholm stage, a political variety show poking fun or blasting at bureaucratic Sweden, savage cuts in the welfare state, and the war in Iraq. A British writer with Swedish roots commenting on the mutual literary influence of the two nations. A Swedish-Japanese cultural journalist talking about the food, culture, and religion of Asia and its reflection in Scandinavian life. And a Canadian resident of New York enriching the international jazz scene here in Stockholm and helping export Nordic jazz to North America. This is Spectrum of the Arts coming to you from Radio Sweden. I'm Bill Schiller in Stockholm. One of the very progressive political theaters in Sweden is called Tribunal here in Stockholm, usually putting on serious plays with heavy themes. But recently, the company came out with a humor-filled variety show, musical and savage jabs at the pedantic bureaucracy and inferiority complexes of the Swedes, and black comedy attacks on such grueling subjects as the painful cuts in the welfare state and the war in Iraq.
My name is Vanna Rosenberg, and I work at Theater Tribunalen Theater.
And my name is Jan Erfström, and I'm also a part of this theater, Theater Tribunalen.
And this theater, which is well known for political plays, what kind of cabaret is this now? Cabarets and hamburgers, what does it mean now?
Well, we want to do some, of course, political thing. And this time we found it would be very nice to do something that's possible to laugh at, because otherwise we often do plays that are quite serious, and we want to try something new, actually.
And you've got red curtains and chandeliers hanging as if it's some kind of a...
Berlin.
Yes, Berlin
atmosphere.
From the 30s.
I'm new here, so from what I heard, it was thought to make this theater look a bit glamorous, but not too glamorous, you know, like a very warm, welcoming color. So it's perfect for this cabaret, I think.
And because of the economic situation on the theater, we can't be like... We will never look like the National Theatre or something. So it looks, it's red curtains all that, but it's wrecked some places, and it's like,
it's not perfect.
No.
But you say in the very beginning, this is the political theatre, and you make a tribute to the people who started this theatre, and then you start making fun of what's gone wrong in the welfare state, the hospital care, looking for a place to live. What kind of sarcastic accusations are you making against life in Sweden today?
We want to do something like it's box in a box. We don't want to do it too easy for the audience. We want to complicate it a bit. So we're just going to start up with just make a bit laugh at ourselves in being that ambitious. But then we are doing it quite as tribunalic, if you can say it that way.
And at one point, two women come out and their men are covered with curtains cloth, and they're tied up and... Yeah. The women are leading them around like dogs. Just, what's this now?
Yeah, you have Islam, you have the religious, you know, the clothing that they wear, and this is a kind of
we want to say
absurd.
Like, this is to say hello to this Taliban thing.
Yes.
The idea from the women married to men under curtains is this burqa thing that Islamic
when the women are all covered up.
Yes.
Yeah.
Now we wanted to turn it upside down and put the men behind the curtains or whatever.
And being led around on leashes.
Yes. Yes. Yeah.
This form, this cabaret form, makes it possible to talk about a lot of different things, which you can't do in an ordinary play. There you have like one or two or three themes that you have to follow. But here we can start up like 30 different histories, and then we can just cut off when we've said what we want to.
Jo, jag har egentligen inte fem, men det är bara jag där ute.
A number of times you referred to the war in Iraq.
Yeah.
One time a military man is playing with small puppets or dolls. What is this now?
I mean, you can't do this kind of play without talking about the war. And during all wars, I think people need to laugh and things. And we don't want to just pretend it's not there. Of course, you think a lot of things about this and the war going on. So.
And also, I think during wars, I mean, in the Second World War, there were so many cultural events going on in the ghettos and like this. I mean, we're not in war, but we still need to laugh at it because it's so terrifying. And so the only survival kit we have is our laugh.
Yeah. At one point, you give some statistics. Who is in favor of the war in Cairo? Who's in favor in Washington and different places?
Yeah, of course. That's what you see on TV all the time. And I think the worst thing with that is that the first day of the wars, you were really up in the morning and turn on the TV. And now it's like every day. You don't care that much. So we try to not unblasé people.
What do you think your audiences appreciate? Do you think that they say, this is a good idea, these cabarets instead of the traditional tribune hall theater with heavy themes and World War II and women who are persecuted by their own family because they've found someone to love in another culture? What do the audience say?
I think that the people that likes to watch the place here, they go here because they know that they hope, hopefully the themes are serious, you know, important themes, but still, you know, it's nice to laugh sometimes. And I mean, I know that people have when they watch the place as well. I don't think it's that such a big difference. This is just something, as Janis said before, it's nice to make a big mixture of everything and also to be able to put in new stuff, to be very, you know, up to date. Oh, let's talk about Michael Moore today. Or
the film director who condemned the war and said Bush should be ashamed.
I mean, because creative people here everywhere, so sometimes Janne shows up and he's got a new text and he says, hey, I want to put this in. That's wonderful. But I don't think the audience, they don't prefer this or that. It's just a new thing.
And then when they go see this, they in some way know that the next play is going to be something really the opposite from this. Because we got the audience, we got our common audience here.
One thought was to bring new people to the theater. That's a good thing because actors and directors, they have, you know, different, you can show, you have so many things inside of you, and this is just one side, and then you show another side. That's life.
Sweden is on the verge of a national referendum on the European Monetary Union, and you're making fun of the EU with a telephone call.
Do you think we do? No, I don't think we make fun of the EU. We make fun of Sweden's way of talking with the EU, being very shy and very underdog. I think Sweden is like that. We are apologizing all the time, and we can call back tomorrow or whenever you want us to, or never.
You're making a call to the bureaucrats in Brussels and reminding them that Sweden exists, that there's some little country up here in the far north.
Yeah, I think it's very self-ironic in a way, isn't it?
And also that when we stand on stage, you know, we're such a small crowd, and we just, like, we have glue between us. It's so small, and it's difficult to move or do anything. It's just a small...
Our way of giving a body to Sweden, the shape of Sweden.
Det är så att jag har fått ett brev om att jag har fått frisedeln.
Ja, det får alla.
Ja, fast jag skulle gärna vilja göra min värnplikt.
Men du vill alltså...
Jag har inte för mycket besvär.
Nej!
A new book called Swedish Reflections, from Beowulf to Bergman, looking back to descriptions of Swedish warrior kings of a millennium ago, and Sweden's world-famous film and theater director Ingmar Bergman, who's just had his 85th birthday. The author of the foreword to this anthology of English, Irish, and Swedish literary comments on each other's culture, British writer Michael Holroyd.
I'm a British writer, biographer, and autobiographer. What does it mean to be participating with your works and your inspiration in this anthology of Swedish and British writing?
I'm really delighted to be participating in this Swedish-British anthology because my mother was Swedish, my father was English, and I've always had that dual cultural upbringing. I used to come to Sweden for my holidays, to Borås, to Göteborg, to Marstrand, to Stockholm, and I've found in the biographies I've written there's always been a Swedish element. Bernard Shaw came to Sweden, Lytton Strachey came to Sweden, there's always been that, but I have never contributed to a book that was purely Britain and Sweden, and I'm really delighted to be able to do that.
And you've written biographies about these people. What did they have to say about Sweden?
Their views varied quite a lot. Bernard Shaw really loved Sweden. He thought it one of the most civilized countries in the world, but he promised not to tell anybody about it because he thought that if he advertised Sweden as such a wonderful place, it would be ruined by tourists. So he said that he would tell everyone that the streets were patrolled by bears and everybody lived on cod liver oil, and that would keep them away. Lytton Strachey, the biographer, Bloomsbury figure, friend of Virginia Woolf, he came to Sweden two or three times, but he was always ill when he came. He went to a sanatorium at Saltsjöbaden. But because he was ill, and because the regime there was extremely strict, and he had to perform in exercises in something that looked like a torture chamber, he came back feeling it was rather a severe place, Sweden, and he'd rather avoid it. He was a hypochondriac, rather, and Sweden rather cured him of his hypochondria.
And I understand, even though he thought it was a very rough life here as a homosexual, he thought the sailors were very good-looking.
He thought both the countries, Stockholm in particular, was good-looking, and the sailors were particularly good-looking. That did appeal to him very much indeed, and I think the last time he came, it was purely for the sake of the sailors rather than through ill health.
Over these 1,000 years, what do British people know about Sweden, and what do Swedes know about Britain, really?
I think they know, each of them, far too little. What they know is something that is a bit of a cliché, a stereotype, and I think that this volume will do a great deal to correct that and to open the eyes of a lot of people in Britain to the complexity and interest of life in Sweden. And vice versa, there's good and bad mixed up. But I believe there's quite a lot, not exactly in common, parallel. And I think that it'll do a very good job, an intercultural job, this book. And I wish it the best of luck.
British and Swedish, but I understand the Irish elements contributes quite a bit. How does that work?
Well, one of my grandmothers was Irish, the other was Swedish. So I'm a hybrid, and I recommend everybody to be a hybrid, not the pure breed, you know. There's nothing like having many cultures, a mixture of streams in oneself, for a rich mainstream, I think. So I recommend intermarriage, such as my parents did. And in a sense, this book is a symbol of intermarriage and of cultures coming together. This is what opens our eyes, makes us less narrow-minded, enriches our lives. That's what I think.
Going back 1,000 years, even to Beowulf, talking about warfare and Viking warfare and the death of kings, has it changed very much? The stereotypes and the images 1,000 years ago and the modern images of Britain and Sweden, do you think, in literature?
I think the stereotypes have remained remarkably loyal and fairly unchanged, but I think things are changing now very much. It's much easier, of course, for people to travel and to see through the new technology what other people are doing in other countries. And we are not so sealed from other countries. We're not so vacuum-packed away from them. This book is a symbol of that change, an intermingling of cultures. We live in interesting times.
What comes next in your writing? What Swedish element appears again and again?
Well, I wrote an autobiography, Basel Street Blues, which deals both with my Swedish side of the family, my Irish and English. And I'm now writing a companion volume, not exactly a sequel, but a lot of readers in England, in the United States, in Sweden have written to me, telling me things I never knew about my own family, and partly sometimes about myself, and then challenging me to say more. So I've really tried. So this is an experiment, this new book. We'll see.
Somliga går med trasiga skor.
Somliga går med trasiga skor.
Swedish Spectrum, a look at the arts in this Scandinavian nation, taking you to the theater and the cinema, the dance stage and concert hall, museums and art exhibits, the international book fair and street happenings, from opera to folk music. Traditionally Swedish to exotic rhythms. From modern sculpture to ancient cultures, providing you with an exchange of ideas for a different future enriched by the past. That's Spectrum right here on Radio Sweden. A series of lectures here in Stockholm have covered the way that foreign food, religion, and cultures have influenced life in the different Nordic nations. The subject of one of these, Asian flavors, here in Sweden.
My name is Yukiko Duke. I'm a culture journalist working in Stockholm, and I also translate Japanese literature into Swedish.
What does religion have to do with the Japanese food? How does religion connect to it and determine what you eat and what you don't?
I believe that, as in all cultures, religion plays a big role in defining for people what to eat and what not to eat. And if you look at Japan, as an example, Japan has been a Buddhistic culture since the 13th century, and that has meant that Japanese don't eat that much meat. From the 13th century until the late 19th century, the Japanese ate very, very little of meat.
Taking fish, mussels, seafood from the sea around them.
Right, mainly seafood and lots of soybean products such as tofu and miso paste used for miso soups as well as for seasoning.
In the warrior centuries, the centuries of military rule and civil war and clans fighting each other, what was the burning energy, the protein that gave the soldiers, the samurai, the energy to fight?
Oh, the soybeans!
It was this.
Right, because with this warrior culture came Zen Buddhism, a very ascetic and strict sect of Buddhism, which meant that the vegetarian food culture in Japan became the dominant food culture.
How about the Japanese cuisine coming to Sweden? What impact has it had? How difficult was it to enter the Swedish society with all its meatballs and its tradition?
Oh, I remember in the mid-70s telling my friends that we ate sushi at home, and they asked me, what is sushi? And I told them, well, it's pieces of raw fish meat that you put on top of rice, which is seasoned with vinegar. And they looked at me as I was mad. You can't eat that. It's impossible. You must be half dead afterwards. And I said, no, it's delicious. Come on, have a piece. And they would say, no, oh, no, no, no.
And now you find sushi restaurants all over Stockholm. Everywhere was a little place selling sushi.
Yes, it's amazing. In Södermalm, where I live, there's a sushi bar in almost every street corner nowadays.
How about Asia itself? Is the Japanese a minor part of the Asian market here in Sweden? The Chinese dominate, or Thai, or Korean? What does Asia look like in
the Swedish food map? Yes. The food map in Sweden? Yes. I would say the Chinese are pretty dominant, as they came first, perhaps, of the big Asian cuisines. And I think that maybe lately the Thai cuisine has been coming as a strong uprunner, but I think the Japanese cuisine as well, at least sushi, is rather dominant nowadays.
You and your mother, I understand, have written a cookbook, a Japanese cookbook. How popular is it for the Swedes to make Japanese food at home, not just go out to a restaurant, but to make it at home?
I think that more and more of the Swedes, having learned how to eat sushi and other Japanese dishes as well, they are now taking step two, which is making this food at home. And then I think they need a cookbook. And my mother and I wrote a cookbook which was based on what in Swedish would be called husmanskost, that is to say everyday cooking in a usual Japanese household. So it's not, you know, this fabulous, enormous Japanese dishes that you can eat in very good Japanese restaurants, but more of an everyday cooking. So it's stews and, you know, this kind of rather easily prepared dishes.
Christmas time, of course, for many Swedes, or New Year's, or Midsummer is a time you get a special table together, your drinks, and it's a time to celebrate. What's the high point for the Japanese when they make their culinary and alcoholic get-togethers?
Well, religiously speaking, it would be New Year, but when it comes to people's feeling for life and for big and nice parties and get-togethers with friends, the New Year gatherings are gatherings where you meet your family and your kin. But when it comes to big parties with friends, then it's cherry blossom time, that is March or April, because then when these beautifully, heavenly beautifully flowers bloom, you put your picnic baskets full and then you take a very good sake,
which is wine.
Which is wine prepared of rice, and then you go out with your friends and you sit down under these beautiful trees and you drink and you talk.
And who's doing this? Everybody, or?
Everybody's doing this. I used to live close to a very beautiful park in Tokyo for 6 years, and the same scenario would repeat itself year after year after year after year. At a certain date, when the cherry blossoms would be in full bloom, you'd see the park filled, crammed with people, all sorts of people. You'd see the aged people, and you'd see young families, and you would see young bachelors, and you would even see the local Hells Angels members gathering under the trees.
But all in harmony, nobody pushing and shoving anybody else, all enjoying the flowers?
All enjoying the flowers, and when you would come near midnight, you'd have a feeling of complete big party where everybody would talk to everybody and drink with everybody. So all these small parties would sort of gather into one big party. You would see the most hilarious scenes.
People eating and drinking together.
Yes, and enjoying life.
Organizers are getting ready for the coming 20th Stockholm Jazz and Blues Festival, starting next Friday. One of these is a Canadian, promoting international jazz here in the Swedish capital and striving to bring more Nordic jazz to North America.
My name is John Nugent, and I'm the artistic director and producer for the Stockholm Jazz Festival. Canadian by birth, but I'm permanent resident of the U.S., and my company is based in New York, and we produce the Rochester International Jazz Festival, which is rochesterjazz.com on the internet if you're curious, and stockholmjazz.com here in Sweden. And it's so much fun to be a producer for this great event. It's the 20th anniversary, and I think we have a great program this year.
What can you give and what can you get by working in two different parts of the world with jazz?
Well, in New York, it's kind of, I guess you could call it the capital of the jazz world. It's where most of the management companies and the artist managers are based for the big artists. So being there in that city is very helpful to this festival, in that I can meet with all these personal managers and agents to make the deals for the bands to come and play here.
Also eager to promote Swedish Nordic jazz in the United States,
Canada? Very important for me. I think that Well, for a long, long time, for the past 50 years anyway, most of the American artists make almost all of their living performing at festivals in Europe and in Scandinavia. Well, I think it's time that the shoe is on the other foot, where the Scandinavian and European artists are heard in the United States, because there are some incredible musicians playing the American art form, and it's becoming a little better now. I just had my festival in Rochester. We had some Swedish musicians come and play there, and some musicians from the Faroe Islands, from Finland, and I hope to do more of that in the coming years.
Organizing, putting all your energy into a festival to make sure it runs, but you're a jazz musician yourself. Where do you fit in?
Well, playing the instrument is the most important thing for me. The business of it is a very important part as well. I'm from a long line of people in my family in the business of music, so it's in my blood, and I just so happen to also play as well. I would love to be playing more, but there are a lot of great musicians, and when I pick the horn up, it's for real every time, and I try to keep that alive as much as possible. I'll be playing somewhere along the way during the jazz festival for sure.
These jam sessions or someone popping up on the stage?
Yeah, you never know where I'll show up. I'll be around.
John Nugent Quartet and Taurus People.
Is not just jazz, but also blues, other forms of music. What?
We have several styles of, under the term jazz, creative improvised music is my word for it. Some jazz, blues, big band, there's some soul, a little bit of hip-hop for the younger crowd, which seems to be very popular these days, and just a broad range of styles of creative improvised music. Under the scope of jazz, it's improvised. And jazz, what's the definition of jazz? That's a long conversation. I think we've covered a lot of bases in the lineup this year at the Stockholm Jazz Festival.
Cries of despair here in Sweden and elsewhere in Europe that interest in jazz is dwindling. People are running for the schlager, hysteria, or anywhere else popular music, but not jazz. What's the situation in the States and Canada?
Well, obviously jazz and creative improvised music is not high on the list of most, it's not popular music, but I think there's still quite a large audience, a demographic base for this music, and there is still enough interest to continue and grow, and my saying is never, never, never give up. And we keep promoting the music, and it's human spirit. That's what this music is all about, so that's never going to die. So as far as humans are living, I think that you're going to have creative improvised music, and we're going to continue to promote it.
Swedish jazz from the Bernt Rosenberg Octet brings us to the end of another Spectrum of the Arts from Radio Sweden. I'm Bill Schiller, hoping you'll keep in touch every day with Stockholm.
You're listening to CBC Radio Overnight. I'm Judy Madryn. That was programming from Radio Sweden. At the end of the hour, I'll give you information on how you can contact them. But up next is the programming of the World Service of the BBC, here on CBC Radio 1.
This is The World Today from the BBC, with me, Linda Duffin, bringing you today's news from around the world. Today, Liberian rebels and government forces battle for control of the capital, Monrovia. Senior government ministers in Britain are under pressure to resign after the suicide of the scientist embroiled in the Iraq intelligence row. Also in the programme, renewed international diplomatic efforts to resolve the North Korean nuclear crisis, and Australia's sharks leave the seas and head for the suburbs.
There are sharks in here, there's a lot of sharks in here, and it is really unusual, and most people in Brisbane don't realise that there are sharks basically in their backyard.
That's here on The World Today. First, though, the world news.
BBC News with Dee Sebastian. Rebel forces in Liberia are once again fighting their way into the suburbs of the capital, Monrovia. The sound of gunfire has been reverberating across the city, with shells hitting areas where thousands of civilians have sought refuge from the violence. At one point, mortars exploded in the city's centre as residents loaded the wounded into wheelbarrows and pushed them to clinics run by international aid groups. It's the third time this month that fighting has raged close to the heart of Monrovia, despite regional attempts to get a new peace deal between the government and forces demanding the removal of President Charles Taylor. In a radio address, Mr. Taylor, an indicted war criminal, insisted that his troops would defend themselves.
I can tell them, the finest in Monrovia, they got into this money. It'll be street to street, house to house, they must be prepared. I will never desert the city, I will never desert my people have died sufficiently. I will fight, my men will be encouraged to fight to the last. We will never desert the city for anyone to believe that by shelling the city, that you have taken it, you will never take the city. We will fight street to street, house to house, and we'll defeat them.
The Liberian President, Charles Taylor. The American ambassador in Monrovia, John Blaney, has asked rebel forces to halt their advance into Monrovia. He said a lasting peace could only come through talks. Member states of the European Union have urged Russia to ratify the Kyoto Protocol on greenhouse gases. Speaking as EU ministers met in Italy, the Union's Environment Commissioner said Moscow would gain economically from ratification because Western countries would invest in emission-cutting technology there. With more details, here's Andrew Craig.
Russia's ratification is vital to activate the Kyoto Protocol, which was agreed in 1997. The protocol aims to bring under control the emission of carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases, which most scientists believe are warming up the Earth's atmosphere and so threatening to change our climate. But it won't take effect until it's ratified by 55 countries responsible for at least 55% of greenhouse gas emissions, as measured in 1990. With the United States refusing to ratify Kyoto, Russia's 17% would take the process past that threshold.
The new Iraqi Governing Council, set up by the American administration, has failed to choose a single leader, opting instead for a three-person rotating leadership group. The BBC correspondent in Baghdad says the council's failure to choose a single leader will be interpreted as an act of weakness, although the leaders of the American-led coalition administration had predicted that a group leadership might emerge. Meanwhile, American military officials in Iraq have begun recruiting for the new army that will replace the forces of Saddam Hussein. You're listening to the news from the BBC. The main Colombian rebel group, the FARC, has asked for a meeting with the Secretary-General of the United Nations, Kofi Annan, to express its view of the conflict in Colombia. The rebels said they'd be represented by one of their leaders, Raúl Reyes, who was a spokesman at recent failed peace talks. The request comes several days after Mr. Annan appealed to the FARC to free all its hostages. A UN spokesman said Mr. Annan regarded the FARC request for a meeting as a positive sign. The first mosque to be rebuilt in the Bosnian Serb capital of Banja Luka since the end of the Yugoslav civil war has been opened at a ceremony attended by several thousand Bosnian Muslims. Security was tight to prevent a repeat of the anti-Muslim violence that erupted there 2 years ago at an earlier attempt to rebuild a mosque. Heads of state, movie stars and business leaders have paid tribute to South Africa's elder statesman Nelson Mandela at his 85th birthday banquet in Johannesburg. Jane Francis Kelly reports.
The audience had a liberal sprinkling of celebrities and dignitaries. Retired Archbishop Desmond Tutu, the Hollywood actor John Cusack, and Bono from the rock band U2. Their appreciation was obvious. Nelson Mandela, who is celebrating his 85th year, came onto the stage with Hillary Clinton. They were joined by Mr. Mandela's wife and the former President of the United States, Bill Clinton. Mandela's enduring gift to South Africa has been his ability to unify the country. And it was seen as a true honor to be invited to a gala dinner this evening in celebration of his birthday.
And finally, the British Prime Minister, Tony Blair, says North Korea and its nuclear weapons program pose a real danger that can't be ignored. He said the world couldn't turn away from that danger or pretend it didn't exist. Mr. Blair was speaking at a joint news conference with his Japanese counterpart, Junichiro Koizumi. BBC News. This is The World Today with Linda Duffin. Heavy explosions and machine gun fire have shaken Liberia's war-battered capital, Monrovia, as rebels advanced into the city. Panic-stricken residents fled the scenes of fighting, but the Liberian president, Charles Taylor, who's defied calls for him to stand down to end the conflict, vowed to fight to the bitter end. The BBC's Paul Welsh is in Monrovia.
Well, the rebels have been pushed back a little bit. They're still in the city, but at one point they looked like they were going to come across the two bridges in the centre of the city, right into the heart of the capital where the government buildings are. As I say, they've been pushed back, but they are still mortaring this area, and there is still heavy gunfire going on. A short while ago, this was the sound just here where I am. This area is packed with about 250,000 refugees who've fled the previous two battles for the city and this one too, and they're suffering terribly. There will be a large number of civilian casualties here. In the last battle for the city that lasted 2 days, 500 civilians were killed.
What's President Taylor saying?
He's saying that he's going to fight door to door, house to house, street to street if necessary to stop the rebels taking this city. But his position is still what it always has been, that he will leave this country as the rebels have asked him to when peacekeepers arrive. The trouble is lots of people are promising peacekeepers. Nobody's sending them. There's no sign of any coming yet. And the West Africans have said in the past they won't fight their way in. They're here to keep the peace, not make it. So I think the chance of anybody coming soon is looking quite remote.
Is this going to be a fight to the end then, as President Taylor suggested?
Well, what he's saying is it's up to the rebels to pull back and to observe the ceasefire that he says his men have been trying to observe, but that if they try to push in, then he will fight to the end. What he really wants, as I say, is peacekeepers to come here to stop the two sides fighting while the peace talks go on, so that he can leave the country, and hopefully, I think what he wants to do is to try to come back a year or two down the line when things are much more peaceful. But at the moment, there is heavy fighting going on for the capital, and there's no sign of the government making much progress, and there's no sign of anybody wanting to end it.
The civilians themselves did try to make a move towards the rebels, didn't they, earlier on, and ask them not to come into the city?
It was quite extraordinary. We were standing just on what is now rebel territory, the main bridge into the city, the gateway to the city, as it were, just near there, waiting to see what was happening. And all of a sudden we heard this crowd arriving, and there were thousands and thousands of them waving tree branches in the air, which is a sign of peace here, and chanting, "No more war, we want peace." They said they wanted to go across the bridge into the rebel lines and to talk to them, but the government stopped them, turned them round and sent them back and dispersed them, saying it was an ideal way for rebels to come into this area. But an extraordinary sight to see so many people who've been battered by war and are so very scared, just saying, "That's it, we've had enough," and heading towards the front line unarmed like that. Absolutely incredible.
The BBC's Paul Welsh in Monrovia. Earlier I spoke to Africa analyst Alex Vines, who spent time with the main rebel group, the LERD, and asked him, is this going to be a fight to the finish?
Yeah, I mean, the LERD are definitely one of their main objectives is to gain power. That's probably the only thing that articulates them together. And they've been preparing for this second offensive. In the last 2-3 weeks, they've been resupplying, particularly with ammunition. This has been coming in mostly to Guinea, neighbouring Guinea, and then transported either by sea to Robertsport or across land from the north. Well, they're trying again. Last time they ran out of ammunition, but as what we're hearing from Monrovia tonight, they have plenty of ammunition to spend still.
This is an extraordinary situation, though, isn't it? On the one hand, peace talks in Ghana are still going on and LERD are taking part. On the other hand, they're launching this assault on the capital. What's going on?
Well, The LURD isn't united either. The LURD that are fighting at the moment in the outskirts of Monrovia are led by Mr. Seko Kone. He is their leader. And he's been very evasive about the Ghana peace talks. He, I think, really does want to succeed Mr. Taylor. And he's probably being opportunistic here, which is why the LURD are now trying yet again to capture Monrovia.
What about the other rebel groups?
Well, of course, there are the political LURD people in Ghana. They do think there should be some sort of negotiated settlement and a transitional system in place for Liberia. And then there's a splinter group of the LURD called MODEL, who seem to get their support mostly from the Côte d'Ivoire, neighbouring Ivory Coast. But the French have put pressure on the Ivorian authorities, which have in turn put pressure on MODEL. And so MODEL isn't really a threat to Monrovia at the moment. They are fairly close to the second city of Liberia, Buchanan, but they seem to be stagnant at the moment and seem more active in commercial activities like logging just now.
So at least it's not going to be a three-way fight for the capital, but nonetheless, terrible for the civilians who are actually involved in this. Could this have been avoided if a peacekeeping force had been sent in faster?
Oh, absolutely. It's the dilly-dallying around. It's the weak signals coming out that the United States might not be involved here. It's the West Africans saying, well, we're not going to go in as a peacemaking operation, only as a stabilization force. And then it's the ambition of individuals like the leadership of the LURD who are taking advantage of a very weakened Mr. Taylor. And so they're launching forth again in this second offensive.
So where do you see this ending?
Well, this can continue. Liberia is under UN sanctions. So really, one of the things that would make a real difference is if the sanctions were properly implemented. That means also that weapons and ammunition shouldn't be getting to the rebels, the LURD, as well as to Mr. Taylor. That the rebels have been able to rearm themselves so effectively in the last 3 weeks and come and try again is very, very worrying.
Africa analyst Alex Vines. You're listening to the BBC World Service. This is The World Today with me, Linda Duffin. British police say a scientist at the centre of a row over the government's justification for war in Iraq died of a slit wrist, leaving little doubt he'd committed suicide. A visibly stressed Prime Minister Tony Blair urged the media on a visit to Tokyo to set aside the speculation and the claims and counterclaims over the death of Dr. David Kelly and wait for the outcome of an independent inquiry. The Defence Ministry weapons expert had told a parliamentary committee he'd talked to a BBC journalist but denied being the main source of allegations that the government doctored intelligence reports in the run-up to the war in Iraq. Dr. Kelly's family paid tribute to a man they described as loving, private and dignified.
David's professional life was characterised by his integrity, honour and dedication to finding the truth, often in the most difficult circumstances. His expertise was unique and universally respected, and his life of achievements will always be a source of great pride to us. Events over recent weeks have made David's life intolerable, and all of those involved should reflect long and hard on this fact.
There'll be no shortage of soul-searching following Dr. Kelly's death. His personal tragedy has put enormous and very public pressure on the British government, pursuing the Prime Minister halfway round the globe. Some politicians and sections of the press are already calling for senior government figures to resign over the issue. So could the scandal cost ministers their jobs? A question I put to BBC political correspondent Bethan Rees-Roberts.
I think it all depends on the conclusions of this independent judicial inquiry, which will now look at the evidence surrounding this tragic event. But there's no doubt that Tony Blair has never been so vulnerable in government. There are some pressing and painful questions facing him and his government. His Director of Communications, Alistair Campbell, his Defence Minister, Jeff Hoon, all these people must be extremely anxious because the realities they're dealing with are very painful. A man is dead because he became embroiled in a row between the government and the BBC. And, of course, the backdrop to this tragedy is a war which so many people within Tony Blair's own party and the country thought he should never have fought.
How damaging is this to government, then?
It all depends on what comes out about why Dr. Kelly's name was made public. Was there any pressure put on him to go public within the Ministry of Defence or from Downing Street? They insist at the moment that he went public because of his own volition. He came forward and volunteered this information that he's met the BBC journalist at the centre of this row. If this inquiry does conclude that no, he was put under undue pressure to go public and to face a grilling in the Foreign Affairs, the Parliamentary Committee, which he appeared before earlier this week, then that could lead to some resignations and would be extremely damaging.
Can the government continue to fend off questions from an often hostile press by waiting for the outcome of this inquiry?
The government line is obviously, look, there is an independent judicial inquiry, we cannot preempt that, and let that find out the facts. That is going to last weeks, not months, we're told. So over the summer, the government had hoped this whole issue would go away. It's going to do anything but that.
Will the government be forced to widen the remit of the inquiry?
It's up to the judge, Lord Hutton. Once they hand over the inquiry to him, then he can go as far as he likes. If he wants to call people, he can't force them to appear, but he can call who he likes. He can demand to see any documents, any intelligence. So once it's opened, if you like, it's out of the hands of the politicians.
Well, Mr. Blair's on tour in Asia with a huge number of journalists following him around. He's just not going to escape this controversy, is he?
No, he's not. There are calls for him to return back to Britain as soon as possible. It seems at the moment he's not going to do that. It's a week-long tour. So he's not going to escape this. He's got the most dogged journalist there on the plane with him in a confined space. He must be going through hell, I would think. He's an anxious man. He's a lonely man. His director of communications is not by his side, a man he's always used to being able to turn to at times of crisis. Alistair Campbell returned back to Britain after Washington. So, no, there won't be much escape for Tony Blair. The only consolation, perhaps, is that his wife is travelling with him.
Bethan Rees-Roberts. Well, as we've heard, Dr. Kelly's suicide has cast a long shadow over Tony Blair's tour of the Far East. He'll be arriving in South Korea in a few hours, where he's hoping to discuss trade issues and the North Korean nuclear threat. The Korean issue is at the centre of a diplomatic frenzy. The Australian Prime Minister John Howard will be leaving as Mr. Blair arrives, and a Chinese delegation has been in Washington to discuss fears that North Korea is developing nuclear weapons. And all the time, Pyongyang has been ratcheting up the rhetoric. So how dangerous is the current situation? Dr. John Swenson Wright is a lecturer in international relations at Cambridge University here in England.
It's potentially a very dangerous situation, and some measure of that is the fact that the Chinese have felt the need to go to Washington to brief Secretary of State Powell. They're particularly concerned because there is widespread feeling that the North Korean claim that they have in fact begun and may even possibly have completed the process of reprocessing the 8,000 or so nuclear fuel rods in their possession, giving them in turn potentially enough fissile material to produce 5 or 6 nuclear bombs. The Chinese feel that there is serious evidence to suggest that may in fact be true, and that obviously has major implications for the region, partly of course because of the direct nuclear threat to North Korea's neighbours, the related risk that this will prompt destabilising arms race in the region, and the very real fear of nuclear proliferation, that North Korea might, if it were to develop these weapons, be willing to trade them for financial support, and these weapons might in turn fall into the hands of rogue elements, and might in turn, of course, pose a direct threat to American national security. What the Chinese are trying to do is to act as an intermediary and get the two sides talking again. In May, there were a series of important trilateral talks involving the Chinese, the Americans and the North Koreans, and effectively what the Chinese are trying to do is to set up some framework in which those talks can be reinitiated.
And is that going to happen, do you think? How likely is it?
I think it's probably on the cards. I think it's a reflection of the gravity of the situation, not only because of the nuclear risks that I've described, but also because the North Koreans have been ratcheting up the pressure in recent weeks. So the Americans recognise that they need to do something to persuade the North Koreans to possibly move back from the brink. The difficulty here is that even if the talks are to take place, it's not clear that the Americans are actually going to provide the sort of inducements that are necessary in order to persuade the North Koreans to actually make those sorts of concessions. The Bush administration has painted itself into a corner, and I think there are many people now, including senior members of the former Clinton administration, who worry that there is a moral dimension to the Bush administration's perspective. George Bush feels that Kim Jong-il is morally repugnant and is opposed to negotiating with him. As a result, the only, as it were, strategy, if one can call it such, that the Americans have at present is to threaten sanctions, to threaten some sort of economic embargo, and to keep the military card on the table, without offering the sort of inducements in the form of economic incentives, perhaps some sort of security guarantee that North Koreans desperately need.
Do you think there's a danger that the Bush administration then could provoke the very thing it's been trying to avoid?
The risk of a military conflict on the peninsula is relatively low. Kim Jong-il is a rational man. He's not likely to provoke the sort of conflict within the region that some more alarmist critics have suggested is likely. But the real risk of proliferation is substantial. And the difficulty is, once North Korea develops this capability, there's no way in which the situation can be adequately contained.
That was Dr. John Swenson Wright, lecturer in international relations at Cambridge University. Let's take a look at the headlines now. Rebels in Liberia have been advancing further into the capital, Monrovia. The European Union is pressing Russia to ratify the Kyoto Protocol on greenhouse gases, and birthday celebrations for Nelson Mandela have culminated in a banquet attended by presidents and pop stars. You're listening to The World Today from the BBC. Scientists in northern Australia are attempting to solve the mystery of Queensland's suburban sharks. These aggressive predators inhabit many of the state's inland waterways. In recent months, two swimmers have been killed in separate attacks. What's confusing researchers is the bull shark's unique ability to survive in fresh water. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
This one's probably about sort of 90 centimetres long. So this one's sort of between 2 and 3 years old. Should be feeding on mullet, bony bream and catfish.
This baby bull shark is one of an unknown number hunting for food in the Brisbane River. It's been caught by Richard Pillins, who's part of a research team at the University of Queensland.
Left her own devices, she can sort of get up to 3 metres, 3.5 metres.
The bull shark is one of the world's most dangerous predators. It has sharp, serrated teeth and is extremely aggressive. Young specimens have been captured to find out why they're equally at home in fresh and salt water. Richard Pillen says the invasion of the sharks has spread far inland.
We're in fresh water, about 85 kilometres from the mouth of the Brisbane River, so we've probably got fresh water for at least 20 kilometres downstream of us. And there are sharks in here, there's a lot of sharks in here, and it is really unusual, and most people in Brisbane don't realise that there are sharks basically in their backyard all the way through the Brisbane River.
The secret of the bull shark's remarkable ability to travel between the sea and freshwater is thought to lie in its capacity to change its salt concentrations to match external conditions. As it swims downstream towards the coast, for example, internal salt levels increase. Researchers have been comparing the functions of four main organs, the liver, kidney, rectal gland and gills. Dr. Gary Anderson says an oversized liver could be the key. It produces salt in the form of urea, which is one of the body's waste products.
Because they retain so much urea within their blood, they have to have good site for urea production, and the liver is the major site, so it has to be pretty big.
The menace of Queensland suburban sharks has been tragically demonstrated further south on the Gold Coast. In recent months, two swimmers, a man in his early 20s and a pensioner, have been attacked and killed. In response, the state government began an unprecedented public education campaign after deciding against a mass extermination program.
Phil Mercer reporting from Sydney. Just when he thought it was safe to go back in the water, eh? Let's get the sports news now. Here's Kate de la Tour. Kate.
Thanks, Linda. The stage is set for a thrilling finale at the Open Golf Championship in England. Denmark's Thomas Bjorn will take a one-stroke lead into the final round at Royal St George's. He shot a 2-under par 69, putting him just ahead of Davis Love III. Behind Love are a group of five, including Tiger Woods and Sergio Garcia. Thomas Bjorn has been in the chase for a major title before, and the Dane knows just what it means to be the leader leader going into the final round.
That's all you play golf for and that's all you dream about. But it's still a long way to go from here, and I'm happy with my game. I felt very comfortable on the golf course today, which probably surprised me a little bit because it's been a while for me in such a big tournament. But I felt comfortable out there. I hit a lot of good shots, very good off the tee. Missed a lot of short putts today, and that's... That just goes to show how well I did play, shooting 69 around here with actually missing a lot of putts. But I'm very happy about today, and I'm confident about tomorrow.
In football, the Brazilian World Cup star Ronaldinho has completed his move from Paris Saint-Germain to Barcelona on a 5-year deal. The details of the contract will be finalised on Monday. And another Brazilian, Rubens Barrichello in a Ferrari, will be on pole position for today's British Motor Racing Grand Prix at Silverstone. Sharing the front row of the grid will be the Italian Jano Trulli in a Renault. Jonathan Ledyard reports.
Barrichello gave himself a good talking to before his lap. Schumacher will be doing the same tonight. The champion ran off the road when in sight of pole position, so Ferrari's number two ended up number one. The session couldn't go fast enough for the Brazilian, who'd been second out after beaching his car yesterday. And that was the story of Formula One's form team. Ralf Schumacher's Williams was only fourth. Juan Pablo Montoya made even more mistakes in seventh. Jarno truly surprised himself, if not Renault in second. Kimi Raikkonen redeemed himself after yesterday's underachieving. But David Coulthard's British Grand Prix hopes are in tatters. His worst qualifying lap of the year left him in 12th behind both Toyotas and both Jaguars.
And that's the sport, Linda.
Thanks very much, Kate. Kate de la Tour there with all the sports news. You're listening to The World Today from the BBC World Service.
You're listening to CBC Radio Overnight. I'm Judy Madron, and we've just heard programming from the BBC in London, England. If you'd like to comment on what you've heard, write to BBC World.